Well, Romans chapter 13, verse 1. Paul writes, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. He says in verse 2, therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it, government, is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it, the government, does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due to them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Any questions? A controversial passage, to be sure. This is a passage that has been used by dictators throughout Christian history, not least of which the Third Reich, as they influenced the German state church. Hitler had a plan to send in his pastors, and they repeatedly taught Romans 13, that you Christians should submit to the government. This passage has been behind a litany of evil. What are we to do with it? Well, as we approach the Bible, we have to look at the historical context in which it was written. The Bible was written for us, but the Bible was not written to us. This letter was written to this church in Rome, and so we have to figure out what it meant to them before we can figure out what it means for us today. To start off, Paul himself wasn't ignorant of evil governments. He himself was an agent of an evil government killing Christians before he himself became one. And even in this letter, we see that Paul mentions the sword in Romans 8:35. He mentions persecution, the beginning of this passage, or the end of Romans 12. He's talking about how we can overcome evil with good and what to do in the face of persecution. So it's not like he's somehow far out and detached. He knows exactly what it's like to be under an evil government. When you think about this composition in Rome, there were Jewish believers in Jesus, and then there was Gentile believers in Jesus in Rome. And we're getting to the part in Romans where Paul is going to start to talk about the different relationships between these two ethnicities. Now, if you're a Jewish believer in Jesus, how might you view your relationship to the government? Under the old covenant in the Old Testament, God led a theocracy. And so it was incumbent upon you to follow God in a nation state. Now you believe in this Jewish Messiah, and you're getting this letter from Paul, which says actually to submit to these evil, wicked, pagan nations and their governments. Wow, just imagine what that would be like. So in other words, if you're offended by this passage, you've got nothing on these first century Christians. Nothing. We read from Suetonius, who is a historian. He writes in his biography on Emperor Claudius that because of the Jews at Rome and how they caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, which most, that is the majority of historians, believe to be a misspelling of Christus, the Latin transliteration of Christ. He, Emperor Claudius, expelled them from the city. This was in AD 49. Paul's writing this letter in the winter of AD 56 to 57. So this had just happened. And after Claudius, Emperor Nero came in, AD 54, this expulsion of the Jewish people was rescinded. That's why you see Aquila and Priscilla out in Corinth in Acts 18. That's before. But here, Paul refers to them in Rome, because they'd been back in Rome for a couple of years. Kind of interesting. Regardless, what Paul is saying here is we're in the midst of heat from the government. The instigation, talking about Jesus, got to the point where it was so incendiary that the emperor just said, I've had it with this, and he kicked out an entire ethnic group because of it. And so what are we supposed to do? He says, be in subjection. We think about this word subjection. The word is hupotasso. It comes from the roots hupo, which means under, to go underneath, and tasso, which means to appoint, to order, or to set. So to set yourself under or to order yourself under. Subjection means to go underneath the government. But notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say to obey. He could have chosen that language, but he doesn't. He says to submit yourself to the government. Presumably because there's times as Christians where we can't obey what a government is telling us. So he says that to be subject. Then he says no authority is given except from God. That's interesting to think about. What a subversive statement considering the context in which this was written. Think about that for a second. There's an inscription from 9 BC which refers to Augustus, who was the emperor of Rome at the time. It refers to him as the Soter, Latin for savior, and it refers to him as God. The emperor was God. He was deified. And here, Paul is saying that Caesar is not the ultimate authority. Actually, Caesar gets his authority from God. That Caesar wouldn't be an authority without God. And so instead of deifying the dictator, Paul is subversively saying, actually, there is a true God. To put it in the words of Captain America, there's a true God and he doesn't dress like him, right? That's the picture here, is that God is real and Caesar is under God, not equal with God. When Paul says that these governments have authority, when we read our Bibles, we know that when God gives us authority in any respect, that we're accountable to him for that authority, our use or abuse of it. So these governments, or rather the people which constitute these governments, will answer someday to God for how they use this authority. That's implicit in this passage. Now, when it says that, you know, God has given authority to government, he's speaking generally. He's not speaking of an individual. The Old Testament repeatedly says that God will raise up people and he will tear them down. And this is confusing for modern readers because we want to say, so did God put that person in office? Did God put that person on the throne? Did God do this? Well, this would fall underneath God's sovereignty, which means that he can do what he chooses. But part of what he chooses is that he can either be directive, that is, he can do something, or he can be permissive, that is, like he signs off on it. He can permit it. He can allow it. So people get very confused when it says that God is sovereign. That means that he's choosing to do what he wants, and sometimes he permits things. And so to set up an institution of government, God is creating the institution, and yet there's these different rulers which are going to populate this office, and those are either going to be directed or permitted by God. Let me give you some examples. Pontius Pilate. He was the governor over Judea. He was the one who had Jesus whipped and thrashed and butchered like an animal. Peter, mincing no words, says that Pilate was one of the godless men. So he's godless. And yet Jesus says to Pilate when he's on trial and, you know, his skin is just ripped to ribbons, he says to Pilate, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. So Jesus can look at this evil, godless, wicked man and say, yeah, God has given you authority. He isn't approving of what Pilate's doing, but the authority, the office, God has allowed this. The Antichrist, he's about a couple notches worse than Pilate. In the book of Revelation 13:5, it says there was given him a mouth to speak arrogant words and blasphemies for, you know, 3.5 years. This is what Grant Osborne refers to as the divine passive, that he was given. It was given to him. From whom? From God. That God permitted him to do this, not in an active way, in a passive way. He permitted it. The only one worse than the Antichrist would be Satan, okay? He's pretty bad. And in Luke 4:6, the devil, Satan, said to Jesus, he said, I will give you all this domain and all this glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. The permissive will of God, that God is allowing evil and allowing tyrants, whether they're angels or they're demon-possessed people like the Antichrist or they're just dictators. He's permitting this to happen. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Paul is laying out here the goal, The condemnation, in my view, doesn't come from God. The condemnation, as you read in context, you're going to read this with me, the condemnation refers to the wrath, the sword of the government, of the state. And so what Paul is saying here is don't oppose, but rather to lay low so you don't take fire. Governments today could certainly wipe people out. In this time, they could as well. We read about ancient history where governments would just come through rape, pillage, enslave, and murder. And Jesus was the one who said in Matthew 26 that he who lives by the sword is going to die by the sword. And so Paul says this isn't the move to take, to try and dethrone Nero in some kind of a violent coup. The goal, according to verse 3, is to win over these authorities, to get their praise so that they see good in these people and so that they leave us alone. That's basically the view. Rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. See, that's just not true. I have no easier way to put it than that. Clearly, authorities do evil things. Many of us here have experienced that. You've experienced authorities doing something which was wrong. And so, too, in the first century church, there were evil authorities. So what's Paul saying? In my estimation, what he's doing here is pointing out God's ideal, that he has instituted government as an office. That's his ideal in order to restrain evil. And so what he lays out here is really the purpose of government. He even hints at this, that they're there to do good for you. That's the ideal. That's the language of idealism. And this is a general maxim. It's not that it's always true. In fact, a good cross-reference would be 1 Peter. Peter quotes the same Old Testament passages from Paul in Romans. He refers to Paul's letters. He's in Rome when he writes 1 Peter. He must have had a copy of Romans. And Peter is almost our interpreter for this section of Romans. He says in chapter 3, verse 13, he says, "Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good?" Which seems like an unqualified blanket statement. Yes? Yeah, who's there to harm you? Verse 14, next verse. "But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed." I just thought you said, "Who is there to harm me?" He's like, "Well, but even if you do, you're blessed as a result." So this isn't a universal truth. It's a maxim that Paul is laying out here. To do what is good, to get praise. Yes, we could compare this to 1 Timothy 2, where Paul says, "I urge that prayers be made on behalf of all men for kings and all who are in authority." Why? Why would we pray for them? Paul says, so that they will leave us alone, so that we can have a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. And he goes on to say, this receives a praise in the sight of God, for God desires all men to be rescued and to come to a knowledge of the truth. In other words, what he's saying is, if the government would just leave the church alone, that would be the ideal state. The church could do its thing, the government could do its thing, and apparently this would be the way to see the maximum number of people come to meet the forgiveness and the love of Jesus Christ. What about when he says that the ruler is a minister of God? Actually, this is another subversive statement when you think about it. In a culture where the emperor was deified, Paul is saying that while Caesar is not an ultimate authority, he's just God's little servant. Like he shines God's shoes, so to speak. Like Christians are called servants. We don't have this big attitude that we're a big deal or something like that. We believe that we're servants in the sense that we are under God. And Paul is saying the same thing about the emperor. When he says that the servant is of God and has authority from God, he isn't saying that governments are infallible any more than we would say that as Christian servants, we are infallible. So just because God can use somebody as a servant, this doesn't imply perfection. Philosopher Norman Geisler says this. He says, "God ordained government, but not its evil." That's pretty pithy. Good way to put it. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. In the context, what is evil? In the context, this is usurping the government. You're supposed to be in subjection. Instead, we're actually coming up and trying to overthrow the government. And he warns here, he says, "It does not bear the sword for nothing." This would refer to some form of retaliatory punishment. It could include capital punishment, not necessarily. I mean, he is talking about a sword. That's what they're used for. What he's saying here is not some kind of political view of capital punishment. He's saying if you do what is evil, if you usurp the government, if you try and take them down, they are going to wipe you out. In 64 AD, Emperor Nero tried to build a big statue to himself in the Circus Maximus, which was in the center of Rome. The problem was in Rome, there was 14 quarters, and you couldn't just get real estate for your property. You had to get real estate up above, in the air above your house. You'd come home someday and there'd be somebody building a house on top of your house. That's how packed it was. And so Nero's like, I really want a huge statue and temple to myself, but everything's jam-packed. What should I do? So he burned 10 of the 14 quarters of Rome to the ground. And then he blamed it on the Christians. So even without doing anything wrong, the Christians were blamed. Imagine, just imagine, if you had a Christian coup where they tried to kill the emperor, what would have happened to the Christians? Oh, it would have been bloody murder. And he says they're an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. To a certain degree, I see this. You know, to be in an anarchical state, that would be the worst possible state. You know, The Walking Dead, The Road by Cormac McCarthy, any kind of dystopian future where there's no government. Even in our own day, you look at Mogadishu in Somalia, no government. Watch some of the documentaries on it. It is just abject terror. And when people complain about the government, I'm like, I get it. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. But then you're like, what's the alternative? The alternative would be anarchy. And that's even worse. Therefore, Paul says it's necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. So he gives two reasons here. Why should we submit? The first is wrath. And who is the wrath coming from? From God? No. It is an avenger. It bears the sword, not in vain. He's referring to the state. If you're not in subjection, they're going to come and they're going to systematically kill you. That's why. And second, to have a good conscience. As Paul ended the end of chapter 12, he said that we're moving ahead and we are trying to overcome evil with good. And there's something about having a clear conscience that you're fighting against tyranny. You're fighting against systematic racism. You're fighting against evil. And you're doing it with good. You're doing it with love in your heart. And you're not fighting evil with evil. When we fight evil with evil, we corrupt ourselves. We become evil in the process. Again, our cross-reference, 1 Peter 2:19, he says, this finds favor if for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. If you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. So the thought that even though I'm taking a beating, think about the end of Romans 8, I'm suffering, I'm being persecuted, but to know that I'm directly in the will of God, that I'm doing good in this world and God approves, that is commendable. Pay taxes. Ah, man. How do you squirm around this one? I can't. Jesus is just like, you got to pay them. Why do you pay taxes? Well, this word for render is apodote. It literally means to give back. And you hear about people saying, well, I don't want to pay my taxes. Oh, the government, big government, they're always ruining everything and wasting money and everything else. I get it. I've heard of all these stories of, you know, how they had to build a bathroom and it cost $500,000 and stuff like that. And you're just like, hate seeing my tax money wasted. At the same time, for me as a Christian to say I'm not going to pay my taxes and yet I'm going to drive on the paved roads outside and I'm going to have no problem having the trash guy pick up my trash. And if my house catches on fire, I'm going to call 911. And if Gary Busey's in my backyard, I'm going to call the cops, you know. And I got no problem with that. I'll use all the services. I just don't want to pay for them. And so we're taught you got to pay your taxes. End of story. Fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Another subversive statement. You might miss this. 1 Peter 2:17, again, honor all people, that's all people, love the brothers, fear God, honor the king. The king is not ultimate, God is. God is the ultimate one. He's the one whom we fear. Of course, this doesn't refer to shaking in your boots. It's to stand in reverence and awe of how awesome God is. Just to bring this together into a big picture, Paul's teaching here is that God is ultimate, not the government. God is above the government, period. Governments are fallible. There's no mistake about that. There's no pretense that Paul wouldn't have known this. But it's better than the alternative, which would be anarchy. It'd be horrible. And Paul is teaching here our mission is not to violently overthrow governments, but to overcome evil with good. That is the foundation upon which this chapter is given to us, to overcome evil with good. Unless you think Paul is some kind of a spectator, armchair, philosopher or something like that. Actually, this was written in AD 56. Within a decade, Paul and Peter both themselves died for this epic. Paul was beheaded, according to early sources, 1 Clement 5, that's within the first century or right after. And Peter was crucified as well. What would have happened if, let's suppose the Christians had thrown a war. Wonder what would have happened. Oh, we don't know. Yes, we do know. There was the Jewish war, which was a decade after this time. The Zealot party in Israel said, we're going to go, we're going to fight these, you know, wicked Romans and kick them out of Rome. And this resulted in the Roman siege in AD 66, where they starved out the Jews so badly that they were cannibalizing their own children. So starving they were. The Romans breached. After about 3 years, they came in and they killed 1.1 million Jews and took off about 250,000 into slavery. So we do know what would have happened if there was some kind of a revolt. Now you might be asking the question, well, what about civil disobedience? This is a biblical idea. Actually, the Bible teaches that while we're supposed to submit to government, when we can, as much as we can, there's a certain line that we can't cross. That line is when the government is actually compelling us to do something which is evil. So you think about the laws today that are promulgated. Okay, there's laws I don't agree with, but I'm not being compelled to do that. But if somebody came in and the government came in and said, you have to kill a Jewish person, you have to kill, you know, something like that, you could civilly disobey. Of course, you'd have to pay the consequences for that. This isn't an easy way out, because we see throughout the New Testament, one time after another, Peter, Paul, Daniel, his friends, Rahab, the book of Revelation, it's actually mandatory to disobey the government because they're trying to force believers to worship the Antichrist. And so we see one case after another where it is actually right to disobey if you're being compelled to do something that's evil. Now, that being said, that's Romans 13. Now we branch out into a bigger subject. The Bible was written to the Romans, but it was written for us today. And so we want to see if we can kind of apply how this would fit in with a Christian view of government. And I have to say at the outset here, this is my view. And if you went down the street, you'd hear another guy teaching something different. And there could be disagreement between honest, you know, faithful Christians on this topic. But the problem for you is you're listening to me tonight. You're not down the street. And so you're going to hear my take on it. But I'm not going to tell you what to believe. I'm going to tell you how to think about this. I'm going to land pretty hard in certain areas. There's other areas where I'm like, I don't know. It's up to conscience. Here's a question that comes up in 21st century America. Should we create a Christian government? You know, if the Bible gives us, you know, moral values and duties and these are objective, then this would imply that we should take that to our nation and have some kind of a Christian government. Seems like it makes sense. Does it? From where do we draw these moral imperatives? From the Old Testament civil law? You know, Leviticus 11 says that you shall not touch the skin of a pig. So there goes football. We wouldn't have that. You can't eat shellfish, no red lobster. I mean, okay, well, those are ceremonial. Well, then which parts do we take? Well, you say, well, that's the Old Testament, and now we're in the New Testament. So, okay, tons of imperatives in the New Testament, like love one another. What, are we going to have a fine if people don't do that? You got to love, and how much? How much do you have to love each other each week? The Bible says to confess your sins to one another. So what are we going to do for that? It's a misdemeanor if you didn't confess your sins to someone this week. See, Old Testament law was given to Israel And it was a bilateral agreement. God rescued Israel and said, will you take this contract, this covenant? Exodus 24, they said, yes, we will take it. They agreed to it. It was a consensual agreement. As Christians, when we come to know Christ, we also consensually agree to what Jesus has for our life. And so it would be inappropriate to try and dictate laws which were given to the nation of Israel. That's not our nation. Last time I checked, we're in the U.S. Those weren't given to us, or to give imperatives that were given to Christians, to an entire nation. And yet, if you listen to Christian radio, this is the rave. Randall Terry, Christian political activist, he says, if righteousness is going to prevail, if paganism is going to be turned back, then we must move to restore this nation to being a Christian nation. That's just how they say it on Christian radio. A Christian nation! And if we're going to reform and rebuild our country, we're going to have to deliberately infiltrate the political power bases of America. Oh, man, that makes me sick to my stomach hearing that. So we're supposed to take over the government. You read it for yourself. What does Romans 13 say? Submit to the government. That's what it says. There's four reasons that I have problems with this. Number one, it isn't biblical. It's just not in the Bible. For one, there's no such thing as a Christian nation. It doesn't exist. Does not exist. You could say, sociologically speaking, this particular country has, 35% Christian in it. Okay. If that's what you're saying, I got no problem with that. But to say this is God's nation, the Christian nation, I don't believe that. And I don't believe it because God doesn't say it. Christians are called citizens of heaven. Philippians 3:20. Jesus said to go and make disciples of all nations. Not just Israel, not just Samaria or Judea, but to the ends of the earth. Christians at the end of history, we're going to be in heaven. They're going to come from every nation, tribe, people, and language. That's four different ways of saying a ton of people, many different ethnicities. No, there's not a Christian nation. This is invented. You look at Jesus' teaching and his example. They came to Jesus and they tried to trap him in this political trap where they said, should we pay money or taxes to the evil, wicked, pagan Roman emperor or not? If we pay, that means that you're like a weakling and you're siding with Rome. If we don't pay, then you're considered a zealot and you want to overthrow Rome. And Jesus says, let me see a coin for a second. And he looks at the coin. He's like, hey, whose image is that on the coin? And they're like, Caesar's. He says, okay, render unto Caesar what Caesar's and to God what's God's. The most brilliant answer you could ever give. What does Caesar want? A little tax. What in the world belongs to God? Everything. So Jesus somehow dodged through this whole thing. So cool to read that. Man, I wish I was that quick. Jesus himself paid his taxes. Matthew 17. Jesus said this when he was on trial. He said, my kingdom is not of this world. If there's one verse you could remember from tonight, it's John 18:36. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting. But my kingdom is not of this world. No, there's no such thing as some kind of a violent Christian nation, something like that. You think about the life of Paul. Do you know who he talked to a lot? Politicians. He talked to the Roman governor Felix, Acts 24. He talked to the Roman governor Festus, Acts 25. He talked to King Herod Agrippa II, Acts 26. He even talked to the emperor himself, Acts 25:11. And early church history tells us he made it all the way to Rome. He talked to Caesar. Do you know what Paul never talks about in any of those recorded statements? He never talked about political reform. There isn't a single instance where now he's face to face with the governor, the king, or the emperor, and he doesn't say, hey, we're being treated really badly. Hey, there's been a lot of persecution. Paul consistently, over and over, shares about the love and forgiveness of Jesus Christ. So much so that King Herod Agrippa says, Paul, in a little while, you may persuade me to be a Christian. But they weren't talking about politics. They're talking about Jesus Christ. And when Paul was thinking back on this imprisonment, which he suffered in 2 Timothy 1:8, he referred to this as suffering for the gospel, not suffering for politics. In fact, you think our culture is bad today. I mean, there's some things that happen that you're just like, so shocking, so wicked. First century culture, I mean, infant exposure, rape, murder, complete disdain for women's rights. You read the primary sources. Hated women, misogynistic, evil. And yet when we read our Bibles, we don't see a single word about political reform or about how to run a civil government. We don't see a word about it. When we open up our Old Testament, we see hundreds of laws about this. Not a single word in the New Testament. I've read the New Testament. It isn't in there. I'd love to find the verse. So it's not biblical. Number two, it's neither historical. Oh, we got to get back to our Christian nation roots. Mark A. Knoll, who's an actual historian, he says the United States was the first Western nation to omit explicitly Christian symbolism, such as the cross from its flag and other early national symbols. Did you know that? Have you read the Declaration of Independence? You read the Constitution. You know what you don't see? You don't see the word God. You don't see the word Jesus Christ. You don't see the word Bible. The closest you come to in the Declaration of Independence is a generic creator from Thomas Jefferson, who, by the way, was a deist, not a Christian. Mark Knoll, he brings up this treaty, the Treaty of Tripoli. This was made with a Muslim nation. It's modern-day Libya. President John Adams signed this treaty, which said the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. This is a myth. It has been invented and it's been propounded. And I could roll out the literature on this all night long. It would just, it would be boring. It's just the same point over and over. So it's not biblical. It's not historical and it's not even helpful. People say, well, I wish we really had a Christian nation. I wish we had, you know, Christians who were doing Christian law and stuff like that. I like to ask them the question, so which Christian person or which Christian denomination would you like to interpret biblical law for the rest of us? Well, if you're talking to a Baptist, they're going to say, well, a Baptist. If you're talking to a Presbyterian, they're going to say a Presbyterian, of course. Roman Catholic, a Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, non-denominated, non-denominated, of course, whatever biblical law would be is what I would suggest to be biblical law. Secondly, whenever we see this, whenever the church got into bed with the state, whenever the church got into bed with power, the church lost its power. It resulted in atrophy, where the church just died, or it resulted in atrocity, horrible evils. Look at this, Pew Research. You look at Asia. Christians are coming to Christ like crazy there. Latin America, like crazy. Africa, like crazy. Europe, way down, 66% to 25% in a century. Why? Because these are all countries with state churches, where it's obligatory to be a part of the state church, to be a citizen. And this goes all the way back. It's Protestants, it's Catholics, it's everybody. This was the norm for the majority of Christian history. And it's led to, when people feel like this is compulsory, like I'm being coerced into believing in Christ, God does not empower that and doesn't want anything to do with it, because he himself doesn't want to coerce us. He doesn't want to see us coerce others. What about atrocities? John Calvin, famous theologian, he ran Geneva. That was his city-state. And there was a heretic by the name of Servetus who denied the Trinity. And in a private letter, John Calvin said, if Michael Servetus comes here, if my authority is worth anything, I will never permit him to depart alive. And boy, he didn't. Michael Servetus was burned at the stake with his books, with his devil-worshipping pagan books to kindle the fire. Oh, we could read about this all night long as well. Whenever we've seen the church and state get together, it either kills the influence of the church or it kills people, even fellow Christians. Fourthly, it's not even feasible. In a pluralistic culture, what if you decide, I don't want to follow Christ anymore? What, you got to get kicked out of the country? What if you're like, well, I don't believe in Jesus, I believe in a different religion, or I don't know what I believe? This doesn't work in a pluralistic culture, unless we're going to start to say we got to kick out everyone who isn't a Christian. Norman Geisler, he says, if government is based on religious revelation, the question can always be asked, whose revelation? Good question. It is simply bigotry to answer mine, and it is presumption to respond God's. Good point. Lest Christians be tempted to say, well, a Christian revelation, we need only be reminded that there is a Muslim revelation too. So we say, well, our book says this, and they say our book says that. Stalemate. Now what do we do? He says in a pluralistic world, no one's religious revelation is going to be accepted by all others as the basis for government. Natural law is what the United States was based upon. The founding fathers, some of them were Christians, that's true. Many were deists, Unitarians. If you don't know what these terms mean, not a big deal. Some of them were Christians, some of them weren't. That's my point. And they got their thinking, yes, there was a Christian influence of general revelation, but they mostly got their thinking from the Enlightenment, from John Locke, that instead of coming to the table with biblical law, we come with natural law, that we can agree that there's such a thing as justice and equality. And from that, what we can do is, instead of referring to revelation, like the Bible, we can talk it through with reason. No, see, that wouldn't be fair for these reasons. And basically, in this viewpoint, which most Christians hold today, most Christians' ethicists, is that we should hold to natural law when it comes to public discourse, because there's actually a conversation. Best argument wins. Well, what about the second question? How much should we involve ourselves in politics? See, I don't really know how to answer that, honestly. You see certain people like a William Wilberforce, who served over in England and almost single-handedly brought down the African slave trade and ended chattel slavery over in England before the United States, and he was a believer. And so I feel like some people could have a special calling. I don't know. I don't want to put God in a box where he can't do certain things. I'm just going to stick with what the Bible teaches here. I know this for sure. The priority of every believer is the message of Jesus Christ. Maybe you've never heard this before. The Bible teaches that Jesus Christ came into the world. He paid for human sin. That he loves you with an unflinching, fierce, undying love. Gave up everything he could. Suffered in your place for your sins. And in order to go to heaven forever with him, you just have to receive that. Now, if you've never heard that before, it could be because there's so much noise about Christians in politics, or Christians arguing about this, or Christians arguing about that. How come you've never heard that before? That message that you just need to receive the gift of Christ and be forgiven. It's because so many Christians have forgotten this first point, that our mission here, according to Jesus, the Great Commission, is to go out and to spread the message of Jesus, which is love and forgiveness. Paul himself said in 1 Corinthians 9:23, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, the good news of Christ. Yeah, and we should be that way too. Number two, if we're going to get involved politically, which we should, I mean, we're in a democracy here. We have the right to vote. Let's use it. But we shouldn't create barriers in our involvement. Paul refers to himself as an ambassador. He says, we're ambassadors for Jesus Christ. So I wouldn't want to be talking about politics, you know, in an amicable way, but then all of a sudden throw in my personal opinion about a political view as though this was coming from Scripture. That would be like an ambassador going over and speaking for us, and all of a sudden he says, yeah, and we want to nuke you guys. The country would be like, oh, so your government's going to nuke? I mean, that could lead to tons of problems. And the same thing is true here. When Christians are spouting off their opinions about politics, and makes us pretty bad ambassadors. Think about this passage here. 1 Timothy 6, this is about slavery. This was bad, man. Paul says, all slaves should show full respect for their masters. I mean, you think if you're a slave, you come to Christ, you're like, so we're going to get out of this now, right? Paul's like, actually, I want you to win your master with love. Why should they show full respect? So that they will not bring shame on the name of God and his teaching. Even slavery, a wicked, evil institution. Paul says there's something even more important than that. It's to reach this person with the love of Jesus Christ. And that's not something that should just be marginalized, like, oh yeah, we've heard that before. That is the mission. It is true, legislation can curb the human condition. I'm glad that we have laws, but it cannot cure the human condition. What we need to see is an actual change of heart. Here's Chuck Colson. Now, he's got some authority. He was called the hatchet man for President Nixon. I mean, he was in the top echelons of government. He came to Christ later. He said, today's misspent enthusiasm for political solutions to the moral problems of our culture arises from a distorted view, both of politics and Christianity. It also ignores the consistent lesson of history that shows that laws are most often reformed as a result of powerful spiritual movements, not vice versa. I know of no case where a spiritual movement was achieved by passing laws. Boy, is he right about that. Basically, what he's saying is this. If you think about, like, all the people in the country or the world or whatever, your nation, and you got the powerful people at the top, and, you know, the rest of us are all have some kind of influence all the way down to the bottom. Which does the greater good? To take over the government at the top or to reach the culture at the bottom? How many social issues would we just not even have if we had people that had a change of life? Let's think about another question. How dogmatic should we be on our political views? See, I don't know how to answer that. There's some issues that could come up that could be so serious, so stark, that I'd be pretty outspoken as a person. Although, I wouldn't use this platform to do it. I don't feel like as a spiritual leader, I have the authority to talk about politics and to pick sides and to promote certain candidates and stuff like that. Now, if we were sitting after this teaching with a beer, you know, I might give you my opinion and stuff, but I don't feel like I should be misusing my influence here. Moreover, public policy, very complicated, very complex. Some people say, oh, it'd be so easy if we did this or did that or the other thing. Okay, listen, usually we agree on what we want. Like, we want to take care of the poor. That's not the debate. If you listen to liberal or progressive or conservative political analysts, they all say we want to take care of the poor. We agree on the what. It's how we do it. And that's usually the debate. And me, I've never studied public policy. I don't know about this. Frankly, I'm pretty ignorant. And frankly, I would assume I'm in good company here. I know some of us probably have studied this, but I wouldn't want to be too dogmatic about this. I don't know. We could have discussion. I think it's encouraged. I like to talk about this kind of stuff. And dialogue, too. This is healthy. It's healthy to talk to people about ideas with which you disagree. That's a good thing. As long as it's accompanied with love. As long as it doesn't lead to an even greater hatred or contempt. That I have these political views and they have those, and so I'm going to have that person in contempt. Hate that person. This is really what's ripping our country in half right now as we speak. And we're coming up on an election that is going to be very serious, very divisive. And we can't follow the way of the world on this. We can have our views, we can talk about them, but to come in with hatred and vitriol, we shouldn't do that. Well, let's end with C.S. Lewis. He says, theology teaches us what ends are desirable and what means are lawful, while politics teaches what means are effective. Yeah, we know what we want, but politics tells us how to get there. If we have these qualifications, we may, of course, state our opinions, but then we must make it quite clear that we're giving our personal judgment and have no command from the Lord. Not many pastors have these qualifications, he writes. Most political sermons teach the congregation nothing except what newspapers are taken at the rectory. Or if he was writing today, what talk radio and podcasts and TV are saying is basically they're just regurgitating what they've heard there. Well, let's close up. As we move forward here, thinking about political discourse and how to love people with whom we disagree, have I read the intelligent thinkers, okay, not the shock jock person, idiot, who's out there just trying to get, you know, likes and whatever on Twitter. The person who's an actual thinker on the other side. Have I understood it from both ways? Like those pictures of a duck and a rabbit. You know what I'm talking about? Some people are like, no, it's the duck. No, it's the rabbit. It's only until you see both that you're able to see the full picture. And so have I done the work there to understand what the other side thinks about things? Do I make and spout off political statements that bring shame on the name of Christ? I would say shame on you. That's not really the issue. It brings shame on Jesus Christ. The people know you're a Christian, and now you're spouting off in this hateful way, and now it makes Jesus look bad. Okay, keep it to yourself. When was the last time I showed love toward people with whom I disagree? How about that? Jesus said you're supposed to love your enemies, not make fun of them on social media. Do I view others with contempt? See, that's really the issue that our world is moving toward, is we're becoming so separated that we can't even listen. We get into these echo chambers, and we turn the other people into a caricature, that they're the problem with the nation. If only we could get rid of them, then we'd be fine. And the Bible wants nothing to do with this, and Jesus Christ wants nothing to do with it either. And so we should take this to heart.